This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Jay-Z has been incredibly successful as a rapper and an entrepreneur, which is pretty amazing since he could easily have been in prison or dead. He was born in 1969 and grew up in a housing project, watched crack destroy his neighborhood, but he sold it on the street before he found his new life in the recording studio and on stage. In his new book, Decoded, Jay-Z offers his story as an example of the story of his generation, explaining the tough choices they faced at a violent and chaotic time. Decoded also tells the stories behind 36 of Jay-Z's songs. He holds the record for the most number one albums by a solo artist on the Billboard 200. His recording with Alicia Keys, Empire State of Mind, from his 2009 album Blueprint 3, has become something of a New York anthem. Jay-Z co-founded the label Rockefeller Records, as well as the clothing company Rockaware. He's the president of Def Jam Records. He's a part owner of the New Jersey's NBA team, the Nets, and co-owns the sports bar 4040 Club. Let's start with one of his signature songs, Izzo, H-O-V-A, produced by Kanye West from Jay-Z's 2001 album, The Blueprint.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the eighth wonder of the world. The flow of the century. Oh, it's timeless. Ho! Thanks for coming out tonight. You could have been anywhere in the world, but you're here with me. I appreciate that. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For shizzle, my nizzle used to dribble down in VA. Was hurting them in the home of the Turpins. Got it dirt cheap for them. Plus, if they were short with cheese, I would work with them. Bored and we got rid of that dirt for them. Wasn't born hustlers, I was birthing them. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For cheesy, my kneesy, keep my arms so breezy. Can't leave rap alone, the game needs me. Haters want me clap the chrome, it ain't easy. Cops wanna knock me, DA wanna box me in. But somehow, I beat them charges like Rocky. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. Not guilty, he who does not feel me is not real to me. Therefore, he doesn't exist. So poof, vamoose, son of a... H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. For shizzle, my nizzle used to dribble down at VA. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. That's the anthem, get your damn hands up. H to the Izzo.
Jay-Z, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you on our show. So let me just start with a track that we heard, which samples the Jackson 5's I Want You Back. Tell me what that song meant to you before you used it in Izzo.
Well, I grew up in Marcy Projects in Brooklyn, and my mom and pop had an extensive record collection. So Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and all those sounds and souls of Motown, et cetera, filled the house. So I was very familiar with the song when Kanye bought me the sample. It was just such an interesting and fresh take on it that I, you know, immediately was drawn to it.
Now, would you mind if I asked you about Izzo, which I think is one of your nicknames?
Yeah. It's like an abbreviation, H to the Izzo, like for Hova is a spelling, and it was like this. I guess it's a form of Pig Latin. It's a language that we used, like a slang. H to the Izzo, V to the Izze. It's basically spelling Hova,
which is short for
Jehovah, which is a nickname that you know, they gave me because it was like one time I was recording in the studio. And I wasn't writing, and one of my friends was like, man, this is like, how are you doing that, man? God must really love you. It's like a religious experience, man. And then he was like, Jehovah. And then, you know, it started out as a joke, and then it just stuck.
Okay.
As most nicknames do, right?
Right. No, and talking about sampling, I'm reminded of something you say in the book that I thought was really interesting. You know, you talk about your parents having a big record collection. Your father left when you were very young, I think when you were 9. And you say that most of your friends' fathers had left. You say our fathers were gone, usually because they just bounced. But we took their old records and used them to build something fresh. It's really interesting that one of the things that your father leaves behind that you can use is his records.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's a bright side to everything, right?
Yeah, well, that's one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So, what were your first rhymes like? You got your first boombox when you were 9. Your mother gave it to you, you say, because she thought it would help keep you out of trouble.
Just so, you know, if I was focusing on music, you know, I wouldn't be, you know, running the streets all while. So she tried to encourage me to pursue my dreams in music early on. And my first rhymes were pretty much, you know, very boastful and, you know, academic, but they were kind of advanced for a young kid. Like, I put a piece of one of them, and it was like, I'm the king of hip-hop, the renewed like the Reebok, the key in the lock with words so provocative as long as I live. And I look back on that rhyme now, I'm like, man, that's pretty prophetic.
So you were about 9 when you wrote that?
Yeah, between 9 and 11, those are my first rhymes.
Okay, so provocative is a pretty big word for a kid of that age. You write how you started reading the dictionary, like looking for cool words to use. Did you find that word in the dictionary, or did you already know
it?
Yeah.
I found that in the dictionary. I had a sixth grade teacher, Miss Loudon, that was very pivotal to my hunger for wanting to know the English language and, you know, discover these words. And, you know, it was a tool in the music that I, in the poetry that I chose to pursue.
Would you describe the Marcy Projects in Bedford-Stuyvesant, where you grew up in Brooklyn?
Yeah, you have these three columns of buildings with four people on each floor, six floors. You know, so you have people to the left of you, right of you, top on top, and on the bottom of you. It's a very intense and stressful situation. Everyone's going through different things. And in between all that stress and angst and, you know, having to deal with one another in such close proximity, there's so much love. And there was playing in the Johnny Pump, and there was the ice cream man who coming around, and there was all these games that we play. And then it would turn suddenly just violent, and there'll be shootings at 12 in the afternoon on any given day. So it was just weird mix of emotions. I mean, you know, one day your best friend could be killed. The day before, you could be celebrating him getting a brand new bike. It's just extreme highs and lows.
How old were you when crack came to the neighborhood?
It was about 85, so I had to be a little earlier than that. So maybe about 12, 13 years old.
And how did that change the projects?
Well, I think what it changed most was, you know, they have a saying, it takes a village to raise a child. It changed the authority figure because, you know, with crack cocaine, it was done so openly. And the people who were addicted to it, the fiends, had very little self-respect for themselves. This, it was so highly addictive that they didn't care how they obtained it. And they carried that out in front of children who were dealing at the time. So the relationship of that respect of, you know, I have to respect my elders, and, you know, Uncle Tyrone's coming. He wasn't really your uncle, but he was the uncle for the neighborhood. And, you know, that dynamic shifted, and it had broke forever. And it just changed everything from that point on.
And it changed everything for you because you write about this in the book, and, you know, you've rapped about it too. You ended up being a hustler. You ended up selling crack and helping your mother as a single mother support the family. Did she know that's how you were making the money?
I'm sure she suspected, you know, as much. Because it was so prevalent, what happened was it was either you were using it or selling it. And that was pretty much the two options. I know there was, you know, and that's a very blanket statement. I know it was a very small percentage that, you know, had nothing to do with drugs, or maybe in their household. But, you know, the brother, the sister, somebody, the uncle, the aunt, it was so prevalent. You know, you could smell it in the hallways. You could see crack vials in the elevator, on the curb, you know, where the water flows, crack valves floating up and down like a river or something. It was just everywhere.
So you'd seen how it really damaged people, crack. And then when you started selling it, did you ever think, I'm contributing to that damage?
Oh, not until later on, you know, at 14, 15 years old. You know, you're thinking about, to be honest with you, you're thinking about sneakers, or you're thinking about some sort of relief from all the pain you're feeling. You're thinking about buying some food for the house. You're thinking about paying the extra light bill. So at that young age, you're not thinking about the destruction that you're causing your own community.
Well, let me pause here to reintroduce you. My guest is Jay-Z, and he has a new book. It's called Decoded, and it's part memoir and part a collection of his lyrics with the stories behind them. And I want to play another track here, and I want to play December 4th because it's so autobiographical and about the period of your life that we're talking about, and also because your mother's featured on it.
Yeah,
we'll actually hear her voice.
Yeah.
Did you say you tricked her?
Yeah, it was her birthday. It was actually her birthday. December 4th is my birthday, which is the title of the song. And it was her birthday. It was September 17th. And I told her to meet me down at the studio that we were going to go to lunch and for her birthday. And she came down to the studio, and I just brought the track up. And I was like, I just want you to talk on it. Because I knew if I told her, she'd get really nervous. So I just I brought it down to the studio, and I just brought the track up. And I was like, I need you to talk on this. And she's like, what do you want me to say? And you know, the rest is history.
What'd you tell her when you said, what'd you want me to say?
I just tell those stories that you told about me, about riding a bike when I was four, and you know, those sort of things. And she went in there, and it was, you know, we couldn't get off the mic after a minute. She just kept talking.
Okay. So here's Jay-Z's December 4th from the Black Album, and also featuring his mother.
Sean Carter was born December 4th, weighing in at 10 pounds, 8 ounces. He was the last of my four children, the only one who didn't give me any pain when I gave birth to him. And that's how I knew that he was a special child.
Happy, what's wrong? You look like you've lost your best friend. Tell me, is it something that I've done again? You look like you've lost your best friend.
They say they never really miss you till you dead or you gone. So on that note, I'm leaving after the song. So you ain't gotta feel no way about Jay so long. But at least let me tell you why I'm this way. Hold on. I was conceived by Gloria Carter and Agnes Reeves, who made love under the sycamore tree, which makes me a more sicker MC and my mama would claim. At 10 pounds when I was born, I didn't give her no pain. I'll go through the years, I gave her her fair share. I gave her first real scare. I made it for birth when I got here. She knows my purpose wasn't purpose. I ain't perfect, I care. But I feel worthless cause my shirts wasn't matching my gear. Now I'm just scratching the surface cause what's buried under there was a kid torn apart once his pop disappeared. I went to school, got good grades, could behave when I wanted. But I had demons deep inside that were raised when confronted. Hold on.
Sean was a very shy child growing up.
That's Jay-Z's December 4th. And my guest is Jay-Z. He has a new book called Decoded. So this track we just heard is from the Black Album. So I've got to ask you how you feel about the Gray Album, which is the mashup that Danger Mouse did of your Black Album and the Beatles' White Album without any copyright permission. So how do you feel about it musically, and how do you feel about the fact that he did it?
I think it was a really strong album, and I champion any form of creativity, and that was a genius idea to do, and it sparked so many others like it. There are other ones that, you know, it's really good. There are other ones that, because of the blueprint that was set by him, that I think are a little better, but, you know, him being the first and having the idea, I thought it was genius.
Did you feel ripped off by the fact that he used your music on it without paying for it, or did you think, doesn't matter, it's really good art?
No, I was actually honored that, you know, someone took the time to mash those records up with Beatles records. I was honored to be on, you know, quote unquote, the same song with the Beatles.
Let's talk about the period of your life when you were selling crack. How did you start doing that?
Well, yes. It wasn't very difficult. It was like
no job interview.
Yeah.
Resume.
Yeah. I knew a friend who knew a friend, and you know, he made an introduction, and we had a conversation almost like a job interview, and it was almost these rules of how to do it and how not to get high on your own supply and how to be a man of principle and of your word and dealing with people. And it was like this advice as if it was a Fortune 500 job, you know, except it was, you know, crack cocaine.
And did you take that Scarface advice of do not get high on your own supply?
Yeah, that strangely enough, that movie about, you know, all this violence and gore was like one of the biggest things to impact our generation. You know, not everyone listened. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do.
Did you listen to that?
Yeah, I did. Yes.
So you write about some of the generational differences at this time when a lot of the teenagers were selling crack and a lot of the adults were addicted. And you say one of the differences, generational differences, was the way you dressed, baggy jeans and puffy coats to stash the crack and the weapons and construction boots to survive cold winter nights working in the streets. Now, I have to say, I've never thought of those baggy pants and puffy coats as ways to stash drugs and weapons.
Yeah, it's like that's what the code is pretty much about. It breaks down some of the things that, you know, the origins of things and how they arrive, especially, you know, with the songs, of course, but also with our generation. Those things now that seem like merely fashion, you know, were purposeful at one time or another.
I have to say, some of those baggy jeans are so loose around the waist, like they fall down to the middle of your behind, and I think if you had a weapon in there, they'd definitely drop to the floor because the weapon would just, like, drag them right down. So,
well, you know, if you had a big enough weapon.
Whatever. So you describe in the book how when you first started writing rhymes, you had a notebook. But when you were hustling on the street, you weren't carrying your notebook with you. And if a rhyme came to you that you wanted to remember, what would you do? You'd go to the store. Tell the story how you'd go to the store to...
Yeah, what happened was I wrote so much in this book. I would sit at my table for hours and hours till my mother made me go to bed. And it was like this obsession with words and with writing. And as I got further away from that notebook, you know, as I was on the street, and these ideas would come, I would run into the corner store, the bodega, and grab a paper bag or just buy a juice, anything just to get a paper bag. And then I'd write the words on the paper bag and stuff these ideas in my pocket until I got back. Then I would transfer them into the notebook. And as I got further and further away from home and from the notebook, I had to memorize these rhymes longer and longer and longer. And like with any exercise, you know, once you train your brain to do that, it becomes a natural occurrence. So, you know, by the time I got to record my first album, which was I was 26, I didn't need pen to paper. My memory had been trained, you know, just to, you know, listen to a song, think of the words, and then just lay them to tape.
And what about now? Do you write down rhymes when they come to you, or...
No, I haven't since my first album.
And your memory's as good now as it was then?
Yeah. I've lost plenty of material. It's not the best way. I wouldn't advise it to... I wouldn't advise it to anyone. I've lost a couple albums worth of great material. Well, I thought they were great when I couldn't remember them. You know, to think about how, you know, when you can't remember a word and it drives you crazy, like, man, I gotta think about this. You know, it's the. So imagine, you know, forgetting an entire rhyme and having to sit there and like, what I said, I was the greatest something.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Jay-Z, and he has a new book called Decoded. So what was the turning point in your life that got you out of hustling and into the recording studio?
It was like events that would happen over the years. You know, I went to a guy named Clark Kent, by the name of Clark Kent. I made a couple demos with him, and then I would leave back into the streets. You know, my cousin stopped speaking to me, thought I was wasting my talent. And I was like 1 foot in and 1 foot out. I always had in the back of my mind that I would be back in the streets for some reason. And I guess I didn't have 100% belief in what I was doing. Then finally, I just said, man, I'm just going to give this music a try. I'm going to give it 100% and just forget everything that I'm doing. You know, and here we are.
So how much money had you been making on the street when you decided to try music?
Well, I don't know if you really have a concrete number of how much money you were making. Sometimes it was really good and it was fantastic. I mean, I did pretty well, which made it more difficult for me. Because at the time, people in the street were making more than rappers. You know, it didn't, and not until the big deals of Master P and Puff deal with Bad Boy, with Arista Records, where people getting really big deals. So for the most part, people in the street were making more than rappers. So for me, I address this in the book as well. There's a song called Can't Knock the Hustle, and it sounds like I'm saying you can't knock my hustle. But who I was talking to was the guys on the street, because rap was my hustle, and like at the time, the streets was my job. So when I was telling people, yeah, I want to be a rapper, I want to do this, they were like, man, why do you want to be a rapper? Those guys get taken advantage of. Everybody takes their money. You know, we go to parties and we pull up in Mercedes and Lexuses, and they pull up in turtle tops with 16 people in them. Why do you want to do that? And I was like, man, I couldn't really explain to them how much I loved it. So I would just say, let me just try it. I just want to see what it's about.
Let's talk about another one of your tracks. I want to play Hard Knock Life, which really surprised me when I first heard it, because you sample the song Hard Knock Life from the Broadway show Annie, which I thought was a real surprise, surprising choice.
To say the least.
For you, yes, to say the least. So how did you decide to use that?
Well, what happened was my sister's name is Andrea Carter, and we call her Annie for short. So when the TV version of the play, you know, it came on, and it was like this a story called Annie, I was immediately drawn to it, of course, this is my sister's name. Like, what is this about? So, I watched it, and I was immediately drawn to that story. And, you know, those words, instead of treated, we get tricked. Instead of kisses, we get kicked. It immediately resonated with me. So, you know, fast forward, I'm on the Puff Daddy tour, and I'm about to leave stage, and a DJ by the name of Kid Capri plays this track, no rap on it, just the instrumental. It stopped me in my tracks. It immediately brought me back to my childhood and that feeling. And I knew right then and there that I had to make that record, and that, you know, people would relate to the struggle in it and the aspiration in it as well.
So let's hear the song, and then we'll talk a little more about it. So this is Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by Jay-Z.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Jiggle. Uh-huh.
Bounce.
Yeah. Let it bump, though.
It's a hard knock life. Uh-huh.
Bopping, to driving some of the hottest cars New York has ever seen, for dropping some of the hottest verses rappers ever heard, from the dope spot with the smoke block cleaning the murder scene. You know me well from nightmares of a lonely cell, my only hell. But since when y'all know me to fail? Nah, we all my with the rubber grips or shots, and if you with me, mama, rubbing your and whatnot. I'm from the school of the hard knocks. We must not let outsiders violate our blocks. And my plot is stick up the world and split it 50-50. Uh-huh. Let's take the dough and stay real jiggy. Uh-huh. Let's sip the Chris and get pissy-pissy. Flow infinitely like the memory of my Biggie. Baby, you know it's hell when I come through. The life and times of Sean Carter, Volume 2.
That's Hard Knock Life, Ghetto Anthem by my guest Jay-Z, who has a new book called Decoded. So you tell a great story in the book about how you got the rights to use that song, to use the song from Annie, Hard Knock Life. Would you tell the story?
Yeah. we got the rights already, so it's a bit late. So, because I exaggerated a touch. You know, in typical, when you have to clear a song, you have to send it, a sampled song, you send it to the original writers and they grant you permission, and you pay a fee for that permission. You know, but some writers, their art is for them very important. So it has to be the right sort of attitude and the right take, and the emotion on the record has to fit, you know, what was originally intended. So we're having difficulties clearing the sample, and I wrote a letter about how much it meant to me, you know, what it meant to me growing up, and how I went to, like, a Broadway play, which was an exaggeration. I saw it on TV, and you know, we got the rights.
Let me stop you, because in the book you say that you told a big lie. In the book you say that you made up that you entered an essay contest, and in the essay you wrote about the importance of seeing Annie on Broadway, which you'd never seen on Broadway, in fact. And, you know, all that it meant to you when you saw it on Broadway. I think you said you, like, won the essay contest. And so you...
I didn't want you to put the whole thing out there. I was trying to, you know, I could have...
in other words, you lied a little bit in order to get the rights.
Yeah, it was you know, it was a bad lie for a good reason.
Well, it worked out well for everybody.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for the song?
No, but... someone just reached out like the other day and said that he wants to speak with me, so I'm going to reach out to him. I mean, just the other day as well, so which is really cool. I was in a house trying to I went looking at a house on the Upper East Side, and I saw this plaque on the wall, and I'm like, wait a minute, that's my plaque. And it was his house. This is a couple years back. I have to share that with him.
Oh, you mean your Grammy? Is that what you're talking about?
No, the plaque for the record, you know.
The gold record plaque. The gold record plaque. Yeah. Okay.
You know, it was like a lot of times platinum, though. But yeah, that.
That's funny. That's right. Well, yeah. I interviewed him a few years ago. You want to hear what he had to say about Annie?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay.
Please.
About Hard Knock Life? Okay. So this is Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Annie, talking about Jay-Z's version of Hard Knock Life. And... here's what he had to say about it.
He said something in the liner notes that it was gritty. He said it was gritty, and he felt that that was the way black people felt in the ghetto. And the fact is, when we were working on Annie, it was the first song that I had written the music for. And I wanted that song to be gritty. I didn't want it to be a fake. I wanted it to show these desperate times and these maltreated girls, et cetera, et cetera. So when he picked up on that, I was very proud of myself for that reason alone.
Okay, so he liked
it. Absolutely.
Now, parts of the street life that you'd left behind when you stopped hustling and started making music followed you and followed some of the people you knew, some of the other famous rappers, into the music world. I'm thinking, you know, like Biggie gets killed, Tupac gets shot. You were accused of stabbing someone, and you could tell us or not tell us what actually happened with that. But I think it's just kind of tragic that kind of violence kind of followed into the music world. And I guess I'd be interested in what your take on that is.
I kind of discussed that in the book as well. Like, when you come into inside the music business and you're coming from these rough neighborhoods, you know, as soon as you sign a record deal, it's not like freeze tag, like everything stops. Like, no, I'm a rapper now. You know, you still have friends, you still have old problems that you've been through. So when people see you now, and just because you signed the contract, you know, it's not like they're going to stop. It's just the reality. You're still a human being. You're still, you have to either know how to deal with that situation or it deals with you. And, you know, fortunately for me, I was pretty much my own boss. So I didn't have much weight to carry. Of course, I had the weight of people that I associated myself with and people that I'm around. And, you know, that night, that's what happened, like a big fight. And then I realized that you're famous now. So it was a big fight that got out of hand. I've had 100 of those. And, you know, never went to the front page of the paper. But now that I've signed this contract, now it's on the news all day and I have to turn myself in. And I'm really like, man, I had a lot of these fights. You know, the guy who got the record executive, you know, I wasn't a record executive. Here it was. I sold my company sold, you know, 1 million records. And you know, I don't know what his company, I don't know if he sold the record at that time, but he was a record executive. Just think about how they frame it. I'm not just blaming the media. I take full responsibility in the fight. But I'm just talking about this since how it was sensationalized.
That you stabbed a record executive when you're saying he hadn't even done anything yet. And you thought that he had bootlegged your album and put it out before the release date. So you were...
Exactly. And he was a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. By the way, it was just, you know, a friend. We had a tussle. He went home.
Did you actually stab him?
Well, it was a fight that got out of hand. Let's just say that.
Okay.
Right? And he... you know, he went home without, he didn't take a nap. They didn't give him aspirin, anything. He went home the same night. You know, they sensationalized it like he was in the hospital and critical or something.
So you turned yourself in on that one?
Yeah.
And pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor, just to finish the story. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, so you do think it's kind of...
It's very tragic, but if you put it in context, you could see why and how some of these things happen. Because if you go through these neighborhoods and places that we grew up in, it's happening. You know, it's not reported on the news. You know, for every Biggie Smalls and Tupac, there's a million other kids that lose their lives to senseless violence in the hood all the time, and it's not on TV. These two guys come from the same neighborhood where all this stuff is happening, and it's happening today, continues to happen, that, you know, everyone wants to ignore it unless it's, you know, a famous person, and it's not right. Every life is valuable.
No, I just have to ask you, I'm sure you've been asked this a lot, but this is the bitch and hoe question. it just always seemed to me that so much about rap music, about men's rap music, is about, you know, demanding respect, but not giving a whole lot to women in the lyrics. And I'd be interested in your take on that.
A lot of these albums are made when, you know, artists are pretty young, 17, 18 years old. So they've never really had any real relationships. And if you come, you know, in the neighborhoods we're in, you know, we have low self-esteem ourselves, you know, and then the women and, well, the girls, they have low self-esteem as well. So these are all dysfunctional relationships at a very young age. And the poet is really just pretty much saying his take on how his dealings with girls at that time. He's not in really stable relationships. He's on the road. He's seeing girls who like him because he makes music. They spend one night together. He gets a phone number. He leaves to the next town and does the same thing, you know, over again.
No, you're talking about yourself here too, when you were younger?
Yeah, as well, yes.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you got over that eventually, that you matured out of that?
Of course, yeah.
And were there times when you continued to write in the character of that younger person?
I mean, a song on my first album was Ain't No I guess y'all could bleep that out. You know, and it was like this careless relationship. And then that went to Big Pimpin' in 99. And on that same album was a song called Song Cried. And Song Cried became Bonnie and Clyde on 2004. Which became Venus versus Mars on my last album. So there's a steady growth in the conversations that's being had as it pertains to women, you know, as I grew.
Can I ask you a question you might find weird, but since part of your goal in the book is to kind of explain your generation and explain the music to people, you know how a lot of hip-hop artists, when they're on stage, they kind of like grab their crotch?
Yeah, I have a great explanation for that.
Yeah, you're like, how did that start? Like, who started that and why? Why is that?
Well, a lot of times in hip hop, like in rock and roll, you'll have bands who tour the world. They get in vans and they tour the world and they do rinky dink clubs and get bottles thrown at them. And, you know, until they hone their craft, until they become, you know, rock stars. In hip hop, the music leads first. So you usually have a hit record and then you throw this person on stage who's never been on stage before, you know, because the music leads. So they don't have any experience on how to perform in front of people, hold the mic, you know, all these different things that you need to know as a performer. So when you get up there, you feel naked, right? So when you feel naked, what's the first thing you do? You cover yourself. So that bravado is an act of, I am so nervous right now, and I'm scared to death. I'm going to act so tough that I'm going to hide it, and I have to grab, you know, my crotch. That's just what happens.
I thought it was kind of the opposite, like, this stuff is so good. I'm going to show off.
that's what we want you to believe. But the reality is, and no one else will admit to this, maybe they will, is you're on stage in front of, now with summer jams and things like that, people are getting put on stage in front of 50,000 people with a record that's a radio hit, and they've never performed before, it's going to be a disaster 9 times out of 10.
So do you feel like you were on stage before you prepared for it? Probably not, because you did parties before that. You had experience.
Exactly. I kind of went through a rock and roll stage. You know, I kind of was doing parties and learning to perform. The first show I ever did, I just forgot the words. I stood there and I tried to pass the mic to Damon Dash, who I co-founded Rockefeller with. I gave him the mic like, here. He was like, man, I don't rap. I just didn't know what to do. I was in shock.
So, but really, like, you've done the crotch thing too, right?
Of course.
So why are you doing it? You're not afraid to be on stage.
Yeah, I just told you. When the first time I performed, I was
okay.
I forgot the words.
Okay.
I didn't do it my last show at Yankee Stadium, no. But yeah, but my earlier shows, yes.
So let's get another song in here, and let's do 99 sure. Problems. We'll do the clean version.
Ah,
it's radio, my friend. So this is actually based on a story, loosely based on a story that happened to you. Would you explain?
Well, it's based on a generational story as well. There's a higher thing. Like there was a time where there was a lot of activity going on Turnpike from New York headed south. Because there were a lot of drugs going back and forth. And so the state troopers at that time just blanketed every single car, anybody that was of color. And it was this term, driving while black. And people were getting pulled over for absolutely no reason, you know, other than their color. So I just had to set the scene up. So now we're driving and we're actually doing something bad. You know, we're transporting drugs from New York to, you know, down south, and we get pulled over by a state trooper, but we get pulled over for absolutely nothing. We're wrong. The cop is wrong. This conversation ensues, and it's racial undertones. And he says, do you have a gun on you like a lot of you are? You know, just that statement right there. And the conversation between two people are both in the wrong, but are both used to get in their way. So there's this clever banter that goes back and forth between the two.
Okay, and we're going to hear the part of the song that deals with the story that you just told. And
yeah.
Again, it's the clean version, so a lot of the words are going to sound kind of...
it's the second verse.
Yeah. And I will say that one of the words that isn't clearly said here because it's distorted because it's the clean version is the word bitch, which... in the context of this part of the song, means dog, because you're talking about canine dogs here.
Yeah.
Because the canine,
That was the writer in me being provocative, because that's what rap should be as well, you know, at times. That was really directed to all the people who hear buzzwords in rap music. They hear bitch or hoe or something and immediately dismiss everything else that, you know, takes place. And everything has to be put in context. And when you put it in context, you realize that I wasn't calling any female, besides a female dog, a bitch on this song.
You know, is that in spite of the opening part that says, if you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I've got 99 problems, but the bitch ain't one.
Yeah, that was to lead the listener down the wrong path if you were looking for that sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's 99 Problems by my guest Jay-Z.
Hit me. Yeah, it's 94 and my trunk is raw. In my rear view mirror is the mother law. Got two choices, y'all. Pull over the car or bounce on the devil, put the pedal to the floor. And I ain't trying to see no highway chase with Jake. Plus, I got a few dollars I can fight the case. So I pull over to the side of the road. I heard, son, do you know why I'm stopping you for? Cause I'm young and I'm black and my hat's real low. Do I look like a mind reader, sir? I don't know. Am I under arrest or should I guess some more? Well, you was doing 55 in the 54. Uh-huh. Lost the registration and step out of the car. You carrying a weapon on you, I know a lot of you are. I ain't stepping out of the door, my paper's legit. Well, do you mind if I look around the car a little bit? Well, my glove compartment is locked, so is the trunk in the back. And I know my rights, so you gon' need a warrant for that. Aren't you sharp to tack? You some type of law or something, somebody important or something. I ain't passed the bar, but I know a little bit enough that you wanna legally search my We'll see how smart you are when the K-9 comes. I got 99 problems, but a b- ain't one. Hit me! 99 problems, but a b- ain't one. If you having girl problems, I
feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems, but a ain't one. Hit me.
That was 99 Problems by my guest, Jay-Z. Do we have time for the other 98 problems?
No. Well, if you can get it in 9 minutes.
So, part of that story is that the cops' canine corps was supposed to be coming after you. They let you go just before the dogs came?
Yeah. I guess it was far away on another call. And the cop tried to hold us. He really had no probable cause, no reason to hold us. So he just said, man, get out of here. And as we left about 10 minutes up the ride, we see this car, sirens blaring, screeching down. And we look on the side and we see K-9 unit. And we just all just a little sigh of relief, like, that was close.
Because you were holding, so it was very close.
Yeah, if the canine would have came, we would have smelt it, and we would have been finished. It would have, no book.
Right. Yeah, no, lots of things. So I really have to ask your impression of this. You know, President Bush, in his new memoir, says that a low point of his presidency was when Kanye West, your friend Kanye West, said at a Hurricane Katrina benefit that George Bush doesn't care about black people. So he thought that was really unfair because he was being called a racist when he's not. Kanye has since apologized to the president. So what's your take on how this thing has played out?
First I find it strange, like everyone else should, that one of his lowest points was somebody talking about him. He's the president. You know, people should insult him a lot. That's part of the job description. People are not going to be happy with what you do. And when certain events happen, like Katrina, and then you see people, on the roof, and there are people of color for the most part, and there's help on the roof. And this is happening in America on TV. And then you see the commander-in-chief, just drive by on the plane, which I explained in the book and in the song called Minority Report. You know, we were all angry. It didn't feel like a natural disaster. It felt like something that was happening directly to blacks. And it immediately brought us back to those images of people getting beaten sprayed with hoses and beaten on the bridge at Selma. And all these emotions, were going on inside of us. Kanye really spoke what everyone else felt. You know, when he said that, everyone immediately was like, that's exactly how we all feel. And that's just how we felt. You know, it felt more than a national disaster. We felt like if that had happened somewhere else, that wouldn't be happening. And calling people a refugee in their own, in their own home because they're fighting to, steal a TV. They can't plug in anywhere. I mean, they're obviously frustrated and scared and angry. The whole thing was just handled horribly wrong, and days going by with I can go on for days. So I think, if Kanye apologized, then he said it. So that's how he felt. But what he said was how everyone felt.
And very briefly, I know President Obama is a fan of yours. You supported him. And you write about how you met him in the book. Very briefly, because we're out of time, because I know you're so busy. Your thoughts about his presidency so far, still thumbs up? Or
speaking of Bush, he's left the worst 8 years of our life. And in order to judge Obama, you have to judge what happened before. You have to judge what he inherited. I think a lot of people would like to forget what we were coming out of and what was left on the desk for the incoming president. I think he's had so many challenges. And, I applaud his effort and, where he's going. Of course, it's not 100%. But, we have to take into context what he's inherited and what he's working with. He's working from in the negative. And if you think that he can fix 8 years worth of damage, well, more, but 8 years worth of damage in 2 years, then I don't know. I don't know if that's even realistic.
Well, Jay-Z, it's been really great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
I had a great time. Thank you.
Jay-Z's new book is called Decoded. You can read an excerpt of it, watch music videos for all of the songs mentioned on today's show, and listen to an audio extra from the interview on nprmusic.org.
Yeah, I'm out that Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pull me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Rabel Donato, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.